What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge From Up. I'm Scott, here with Michael and Drew as always, and this is the Elder Scrolls podcast, and today we are talking all about the Daedric Prince of Destruction and many other things. So let's get into it. Which one of you would like to start?
It's Drew the Daedrologist taking it away with his Mehrunes Dagon t-shirt. With his red fist raised to the sky.
Rage Against the Machine.
He's disturbed.
Yeah, look.
With Daedric Crescent on an album cover.
Mehrunes Dagon, you know, favourite prince. It's hard for him not to be because he's got so much lore and so much love. But, you know, with the ESO expansion coming out soon, another invasion from the Deadlands. And, you know, he's really getting love when some other Daedric princes could probably use it. But, hey, I like him, so I'm not complaining.
Yeah, I don't think the citizens of Tamriel like him as much as you do. He's caused them, and he will keep causing them trouble because he's so popular in our world. You know, it's like some deep connection there. But he's going to cause them a lot of problems, and they're going to see him as a prince of annihilation and destruction, and he's going to be terrifying. But the cool thing about him, at least to us, because we're not subject to all of his destructive tendencies, is that he's also a Daedric Prince of ambition and change and revolution, so that the old can be taken down and the new can kind of, you know, come into being.
Well, that's something to establish straight away, is that he's chaotic neutral. You know, like he's on no one's side at the end of the day. He's just against the most powerful, whoever that happens to be. And, you know, as that turns and, you know, the cycle of who's on top and who's on the bottom changes, who he favors is going to change as well. So he's not pure evil, but you know, when your house is getting burned down and you're all getting slaughtered, he probably seems that way, and rightfully
so. He's pretty on brand for what generally the Daedra are, as like embodiments of sort of like Padme, of like chaos and so on. That idea, like, he's quite literally just change, really.
Although I feel like saying he's chaotic neutral is a little bit, I don't know, nice. I mean, I know what you mean as the concept, but it's like you could cause change and like revolution in a less torturous, fiery and painful way.
Yeah, but
less
like
hellish landscape kind of like.
It's kind of like, I guess, if Molag Bal is like chaotic evil, if you know what I mean. Like, they're on different levels. They're not like, I think like Dagon's stuff is just a lot of the time it's like, I guess, you know, he's positioned against the status quo all the time, and the status quo doesn't like that, of course. Like, the Empire doesn't like the fact that there's a, you know, Oblivion invasion taking over their lands.
No, I more just mean, like, you could have, like, some more, I don't know, it would be more boring, but a more boring Prince of Revolution that kind of just, like, I don't know, sprinkles in little subterfuge or, like, you know.
Well, I don't want to get too deep in the metaphysical too soon, because, you know, like, we'll save that a bit. We'll, you know, not dive right into it. But when you look at it through his kind of origin story and you speculate based on that, it's kind of the ultimate revolution, because it's fundamentally based around the idea of mortals being these trapped beings stuck in this mortal plane who are all doomed to die. So his kind of first revolution is like a rebellion against the very like nature of being mortal, to kind of like to make everyone become immortal again, which is kind of gnarly, but you know, an intense topic.
Yeah, I mean, we can get all into the Magna Geese story and Lig and him being a Daedric Prince of Hope as well. That makes him sound a lot nicer, doesn't it? I'm a Daedric Prince of Hope.
Yeah, I
it's
guess
the one thing we all have that unites us.
Yeah. Rogue One. But yeah, I think we could honestly actually just, we could get into that now if you wanted, because it is his origin. You know, origin's a decent place to start. So we could get into it if you want to do that now.
Okay, well, I'm like, you know, going into, if you've read, or, you know, if you've heard from Mankar Cameron when you've played Oblivion or read the Mythic Dawn commentaries, he's very cryptic, kind of like tries to be a bit like Mehrunes Dagon in that sense. But when you boil a lot of it down, the really cool thing about Mehrunes Dagon's origin story is you have the Magna Gee, so Lig is this kind of adjacent place, this other version of Tamriel. Perhaps it's like a failed attempt by Lorcan to make Tamriel that's previously been destroyed. But the Magna Gi, kind of, that there were these tyrant, the dregs that you see under the water around Tamriel were tyrant kings in Lig, and they were enslaving everyone. So the Magna Gi created Maerun's Dagon in the bowels of that continent, kind of essentially as a means to topple that empire of dregs and allow for someone else to take up the mantle. So they made him of basically pure hope. But it kind of backfired on them, because what Maerun's Dagon did with that is he looked and said, huh, the real tyrants are the gods. So he started a revolution against the very nature of the world, against the gods, and destroyed the whole world as a result.
Yeet. That's pretty, it's pretty gnarly stuff.
You know, it's pretty crazy.
And that's how he's under... And I guess to preface this as well, like, this is all from the Mythic Dawn commentary. So it is like a sort of a more like esoteric understanding of him, like even within the world itself, because like other religions will sort of explain him differently, or he'll be portrayed differently in like less of a... Like, obviously, there's a little bit of a favorable twist.
It's one guy's interpretation, you know, which is fun to take very seriously.
Because a lot of other people... So I was just going to say, a lot of other people would just interpret him as another Daedra that, you know, was there when the world was created and didn't put his power into it, right?
The one thing, I guess, is that it is... Maerun's Dagon wrote the Mysterium Xarxes, which the Mythic Dawn commentaries on, and like translations and so on. So you could, you know, you could cast doubt over that and, you know, them like wanting to translate in a particular way or whatever. But still, at least there is like a core source material that was written by him.
And I don't think that Maerun's Dagon would want to say he was created by the Magna Gi either, if it wasn't true. Like, it's not exactly like, you know, if you wanted to position yourself as powerful, you'd say, I'm the oldest Daedra, I've always been around, I'm so strong, look at me.
Yeah.
So, to be like, oh, I was actually created by Magna Gi, it just sounds like a, I don't know, weird thing to lie about in the realm of, you know, divine entities.
Well, it gets hazy because a lot of, you know, linear time that mortals would be used to doesn't really apply to the gods outside of the mortal realm, and, you know, in Aetherius and in the Plains of Oblivion, it's very much subject to change. So you can have all these stories about, oh, I guess that inherently means that Meridia being a part of the Magna Gi predated Maerun's Dagon. But it's like, well, when we say predated, what does it really mean to gods? They're immortals. They, you know, if you're in their realms, they can make time flow however they want
it to. It's interesting too that the whole idea of the Mythic Dawn, you know, being like a reference to the Dawn era and a cyclical sort of nature of things. You know, we talk about Kalpas and so on, and how that there's an idea that the beginning and end are the same thing. The end of a previous Kalpa is just the start of the new Kalpa, and the Dawn era is that craziness in between. That he's just sort of like... It's a funny way of thinking about him, but he's just like obsessed with restarting. Like, it's kind of like things get built, but it wants to tear it down and restart, you know?
So you Maerun's Dagon playing Skyrim back in the day? You make your character, you get to level 37, you pick one wrong perk, you're not happy, restart.
Yeah, he's a min-maxer. He's like, this playthrough's shit, so I'm going to start again. Down with the tyrant dregs.
Yeah.
But, the whole revolution angle really is from the Mythic Dawn for the most part, I think. There's little hints of him. I do like in Reachman mythology, he's considered the ambition angle is there as well, and along with destruction and so on. But I kind of do like visualizing like the ambitious part of things as part of Maerun's Dagon's sphere, because ambition... I don't want to say like it's inherently like destructive or whatnot, but like usually an ambition is to like acquire something or do something or bring about like, you know, a change or something. So if you're going to become an emperor, you're going to do all of these, you know, all the various things that are required, all the conquests, all the, you know, politics and stuff like that to get somewhere. So that kind of ambition is inherently destructive, you know?
Mm. Well, while I've been a bit of an apologist for Dagon so far, it depends on your perspective as well, because, you know, if you look at the differences between elves and men, for the most part, you know, elves can be kind of resentful for their mortality, and they believe that they belong with the gods, back in Aphirius. But if you're a human, most of the time they're thankful for Lorcan for creating the world and making them, you know, exist and allowing them to have families and you know, lives. So when, you know, you've got the Oblivion Crisis that happens in Cyrodiil, or, you know, like, that's where we see it from, for most of these innocent humans, they're like, can you just go away? Yeah. We're just trying to live our lives here. They're not too pleased about it, you know.
That's...
You have to be kind of like Mankar Cameron and get really into what they're trying to achieve here. But it's like, you know, a mass suicide in order to escape mortality, and then, you know, you could be getting sold something that's not quite as nice as it sounds anyway. So
I feel like, too, we should bring up, and we've made videos on this before, but about how Mehrunes Dagon was sort of inadvertently successful with the Oblivion Crisis. Like, even though he didn't immediately get, like, I'm going to restart the Dawn Era or so on, but his whole idea of enacting his fear and, like, bringing about great change, like, the Oblivion Crisis is the catalyst for the Empire's current downfall, the rise of the Thalmor, and various other events all over Tamriel that, you know, gives you the world that you've got in the events of Skyrim. So he does... So it's cool, but, like, also, you kind of got to be careful with those kinds of things sometimes, because I guess, like...
You could give him way too much credit. Like, you could just be like, everything that flowed on from here was because of Mehrunes Dagon. But if you look at the real world, you could say that about so many events that are, you know, large, but had no intention of changing the world, but they did. But then that doesn't mean that everything... In terms of, like, butterfly effect, it's like, yes, everything flows on from there. But in terms of kind of just, like, direct cause and effect, it's like, you can't just give credit to every single event from that.
Yeah, it's just basically you can't credit him with the entirety of the butterfly effect, if you know what I mean. Because it's like, you know, events happen, but he's like, oh yeah, I won anyway because, you know, all these things. Even though it was, the Oblivion Crisis was a fairly direct one, I guess, but, you know.
It's just a big cope. I'm sure,
plus,
pretty much.
Most of Tamriel suffered as well. Yeah. So kind of like, it is a bit of an equalizer that the Empire were the strongest and they probably suffered the most, but almost everyone, with the exception of perhaps the Argonians, suffered pretty drastically as a result of Mehrunes Dagon's work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess initially, until the Thalmor just capitalized and swept through, and now they're taking over a whole lot, and I really hope we get to find out in Elder Scrolls 6 what happens with them. Gosh. Just being in such a...
Maybe we need to bring Mehrunes Dagon back to take down the Thalmor now. They're getting too OP. He's just basically the devs coming in to nerf whatever faction is getting too strong.
Yeah. I'd, because, like, speaking about the whole Oblivion Crisis thing and, like, how, like, you know, he's kind of just the whole idea that that's just the catalyst event. It's kind of like a bit of a cope in the way he was just unsuccessful. But he kind of is continuously unsuccessful. Like, you know, working with, you know, Jaegar Than against, like, you know, in Battlespire and so on. And presumably in this new Elder Scrolls Online thing, there's going to be some kind of, like, failure on his part because he can't take all over Tamriel and stuff this time.
But then I guess then he doesn't want to win. I mean, he does, but he doesn't in the way that if he did win, then wouldn't he just be another Daedric Prince of domination like Molag Bal? And
I won.
It's mine. I own Tamriel. Then what?
I think it's more a case of there's protagonist magic that keeps beating him back. Like,
no. I'm saying is, but if he did win, then his entire sphere is kind of like...
I think he would be on, like, he's like the Great Reset, just wants to, like, start the Dawn Era again, and then he would wait to whoever gets to the top dog position again. It's like, nah, we've got to tear them down.
Yeah, I think if he won, there'd be nothing for him to claim. If he truly won, then he would have undone it all.
Yeah, he would have to, like, at some point be removed from the equation or, like, be reset himself.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to feel sorry for him when he comes back in ESO, because normally he's got to deal with one protagonist, but now he's got, like, hundreds of thousands of people logging in as protagonists to take him down. So he's
really metaphysical. Like, the more worship they get, the more powerful they get, but the more players kill them in Elder Scrolls Online, the more they're weakened permanently.
It might also not be an invasion story, and it might be going into Oblivion more so and interacting with the Mysterium Xarxes and Mehrunes, like, in his realm more so. I'm sure it's got some kind of crisis, but I'm kind of hoping it's not another invasion. Like, it can't be another invasion, please.
It would feel silly. It would invalidate everything so far. Like, when you speak, I mean, I know this already happens. It already does happen for sure. But it would just feel even sillier when you talk to an NPC in Oblivion and they're like, the Oblivion Crisis, nothing like this has ever happened before, kind of thing. And
it's, well, like, it's the same thing with Mehrin's,
I know it's the same Molag with Molag Bal,
but what I'm saying is it would be extra worse if Molag Bal, I mean, and Mehrin's Dagger do it with a period of 10 years.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, depending on where you are in your story, you could be dealing with a plane meld and this Mehrin's Dagon thing simultaneously, yeah, which just seems a bit ridiculous.
Yeah, they need to watch your Daedra That Need More Love video. Should have done one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of those get a little bit more in some of the new lore, but it's like more so background lore for them, not really like intense. You know, they don't get a whole DLC to themselves, which, you know, they should. But we could start talking about some of the things he's done and so on. We could even go, like, I guess chronologically, if we like, we can kind of go through it. But there's a reason Sotha Sill has it out for him, because they're supposedly the House Sotha in the early First Era was destroyed by Mehrin's Dagon himself, and that's why there is no house anymore. And this is just a, like, I used to get confused by this a long time ago, so I know it can be confusing for people, but Kaima / Dunma culture, they at least used to in ancient stuff use their, like, family name or clan name as their first name. So, like, that's why it's Indoral Nerevar, is because he's like, his personal name is Nerevar, but his family name's Indoral, and so he's like Sotha Sill, like from House Sotha. So his name's like Sill, but Sotha is his house name.
So you would have like House Scott. Like, sorry, I mean, you wouldn't. That's what I'm saying. You wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that'd do it.
That would be wrong. But yeah, House Sotha was like a small insignificant one from my understanding. The main thing he destroyed was the town, right? Ald Sotha, which was like a settlement or...
Yeah, I think Ald is something along the lines of
Old Sotha in Dunmeris was an ancient ruined settlement. But before it wasn't ancient and ruined, it was alive and then destroyed by Mehrun's Dagon.
And I guess the import in the regards to the importance of, we can just touch on it with Mehrun's Dagon in Dunma theology, is one of the four corners of the House of Troubles, which also include Malakath, Sheogorath, and Molag Bal. There you go. But Mehrun's Dagon specifically, like, he is seen as kind of like the test of like the environment in their regards. So sort of like all like the volcanic harsh lands and the, you know, the terrible storms and ash storms and stuff they have, and all of basically natural disasters and so on is where he's sort of associated. Like, because in the Dunma theology, each of the four corners of troubles represents certain tests for the Dunma people. So like Sheogorath is like the mental test of, like, you know, they try and make you mad. You know, Molag Balzac tries to corrupt the bloodline and the Dunma purity. It tests them there. And Malakath is supposed to be like the physical kind of test of, like, you know, the orcs coming to fight them and make sure they're still good warriors. And then Mehrun's Dagon encapsulates the, like, actual, like, environmental test, sort of like the survivalist-y kind of
thing. I think it's also like their will. I believe I remember reading something like testing their will to live and prosper. And yeah, he does literally represent that terrain of Morrowind in their theology, like the, you know, rocky, fiery, you know, not super hospitable in all areas terrain.
It's one of the things that really separated the Kaima, making them the changed ones from the Ultima, who kind of go on to be the Ultima, is that it's like, you know, don't just be upset that you're immortal, you are amortal, not immortal. Rather, see it as a test, overcome it. And, you know, if you look at someone like Vivek, he's kind of the perfect example of someone who took that very literally.
Mm.
You know.
But then it's interesting how that whole Dunma society then becomes like antithetical to that, because they have these tribunal gods that sort of, you know, more or less coddle them and give them this like little nice golden age. And then seemingly the Daedra don't like that either, because, you know, Mehrun's Dagon gets summoned by a witch or something, or no, it was the daughter of, gets summoned by a woman and destroys Mournhold. But actually, I can't remember who she was. She was either a witch or conjurer or something who was slighted by the Duke of Mornhold. I can't.
Yeah, I'm blanking on this too. But yeah, I mean, that's essentially what's happening here, is that this tribunal is kind of, you know, they've gained an immense amount of power, and you know, they're becoming obsessed with being, you know, at the top of the food chain, and they kind of just, you know, that kind of goes against their old gods. So they kind of like, oh, they were the anticipations of us, let's put them away and forget about them. It kind of like, you can't really worship them simultaneously.
And it would be in Dagon's sort of sphere anyway to want to like take down the tribunal. Like, it's another sort of example of like a status quo, like let's get revolution change going. So they're kind of opposed, I guess, in that way as well. There is also some stuff with the battle spire and so on, which is a big part, and things that happen before that to set up the events of battle spire. But I feel like we've covered this a few times. We talked about battle spire when talking about the artifacts and so on, but it really is a pretty straightforward story, like sort of in dealings with Jaegar Tharn's, like, yeah, I'm going to attack the battle spire and try and invade the realm that way, and you, the apprentice, use various cool artifacts to like fend him off. It's a story of an action game. It's not like a
It's interesting because it kind of brings in one of the ideas that kind of gets glossed over a lot, of like the ideas of the true name of something to be used as a source of power. It's like, it can be quite common in fantasy stories, but so that it's called the Nimic, is like, by finding Meereen's Dagon's true Nimic, they could kind of take him down. And you see a lot of that from Mankar Cameron when he's reading the Mysterium Xarxes and interpreting it. He learns about his proto-nimic is how he was born, and his neo-nimic was him shedding the old and kind of embracing this new identity, which is kind of why he's one of those characters who's so hard to say, oh, he's a Bosmer, or he's an Altmer, he's an Aeliad, he's like whatever. You can't really put your finger on who or what he is.
He's a Bethesda plot
for
hole.
The same reason.
And you can banish a Daedra, even Meereen's Dagon, if you know their nimic, right? Like, I remember hearing, if anyone ever meets Meereen's Dagon and you want to get rid of him, or summon him perhaps with his full incantery name, it's really long. It's because some people, I think, just have a protonymic and some have a neonymic, and then others have both. And if you have both, then you need to say both of them, because if you just say one, it won't have any effect. Meereen's one is like Lekelaga. That's actually all right. Lekelaga, I think that's the first part. And the second part's really hard, and that's like Jekelaho Debe Efe. Yeah, it's just silly.
See, he's made it complicated, so you can't use it on
that's
him.
It.
That's the whole
that's
plan.
It. I can't say it. But if I had to save the world, I could definitely learn to say it. So
it's kind of funny. Like, I don't know if this was an effect of Meereen's Razor before the time of Battle Spire, but it's kind of funny how he was probably quite burned by the fact that he was banished after the events of Battle Spire, because if you pick up Meereen's Razor, you know, when you kill instantly, you're essentially banishing them to be their souls to be captured by Dagon, but you can't use the instant kill banish effect on Meereen's Dagon if you were to try it in, you know, in Oblivion.
Yeah.
You can't do
although
that.
You can kill him, I think, with just raw damage.
Can you really?
Yeah, like, I remember shooting him so much, and I'm pretty sure I used some crazy exploits to get some, like, 20,000 damage arrows and stuff. But I remember he actually melted. Like, he full went... You know how, like, sometimes Bethesda... I mean, I had it happen in Cyberpunk too, like exactly the same. But when a character kind of like melts and like their limbs just like start spaghettiing, like they're in space and like they kind of drift out. Basically, I did that to Meereen's Dagon, except he just went straight down. So his kind of body fell and his head fell, and it was like this big stretchy like lasagna just straight into the floor.
You need to try and recreate that, because I want you to record
it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. Like, there's no way I'm very certain someone else would have captured it.
Well, there you go. He can be destroyed. Yeah. Who needs Martin Septim when he can just get 20,000 damage
The problem
arrows?
Is the quest continues still. It just... And I'm pretty sure if you go into the Temple of One after doing that, he'll still appear, like, scripted.
As a spaghetti monster.
No, just scripted, like, normal. Yeah.
So, well, we can start talking about some of his artifacts, and I know, Drew, that you love the Mysterium Xarxes so much. But, like, we can start talking about why this book is so compelling.
It's only because it was scribed in the deserts of rust and wounds.
I mean, that's a cool line. But besides that...
Some fans have like transcribed what it says on the pages you can physically see. You know, and I can read off some of that. But what's interesting is actually in a video I've pretty much just finished is it's... You kind of need to use it alongside, or this is my interpretation anyway, is that for Mankar to kind of extract its full potential, he needed to use it alongside the razor. You know, you couldn't have one without the other.
Why is that?
Essentially, that was his way of kind of absorbing the information he discovered, was by essentially like kind of cutting into himself as he learned the secrets. But yeah, this Mysterium Xarxes, you know, because it kind of, it gives the... Mankar's translation is what gives you the kind of the rules as to how to discover the Mythic Dawn and stuff. So it's you know, there's like
that would be a really creepy spiritual take, wouldn't it? It's like you know how everyone's spiritual is like everyone's looking at external things. Really, you have to go within. And then there's him with his blade like cutting open himself. That's dark. He's actually going in.
That's right. Yeah, the. I like how it's often his, even Dagon's referred to, like, as the Razor as well, in part. Like, they're kind of, like, synonymous. And, I mean, I guess even if you want to look at it on a really, like, materialist sort of kind of view of it, like, he quite literally is in the way that the Daedric artifacts are a piece of the Daedric Prince anyway.
Well, and the Mysterium Xarxes is sometimes called the Book of Razors. And, you know, it's, I don't think it's any coincidence that when Mankar describes reading it, he says each word is razor-fed, and he says it's tarnished like red drink. Twice he mentions razor-fed and red drink, like, the, you know, red drink obviously being his blood, and razor-fed kind of like, to me, that seems more literal than it seem than you'd think. And that's kind of how he took it. But, you know, it's like you got the come slow and bring four keys. And, you know, in my first arm a storm, my second the rush of plagued rain, the third all the tinder of Anu, the fourth the very eyes of Padhom. It's like, you know, you kind of have to decipher it a bit, and at times it doesn't really make any sense, but it's like, it's pretty badass.
He's just the god of shaving, dude.
Yeah, I was about to say that. We need one of those generic YouTube sponsors like Dollar Shave Club or something. get that for this video. Well,
that's kind of the theory with you know, the razor, is that you are shaving with it. You're not going to use it to kill. You're shaving, but you're not shaving away anything physical, like shaving your beard. You're shaving away metaphysical elements of yourself. Like, the idea is Mankar Cameron shaved away his birth, his, you know, the genetics he inherited from his parents, which were likely Bosmeri, and kind of just crafted his own body with the dragon's blood in it, allowing him to wear the Amulet of Kings.
Here's a little theory to put a hole in everything. What if razor fed just means like Mehrunes Dagon is telling him this, like, as in, like, fed from the razor, like Dagon being called the razor?
I mean, I get it's no more or less. Just, we can confirm
it's
it,
just,
but
yeah,
it's just boring.
Yeah, it is.
Cooling,
it is.
Yeah,
there's nowhere near as cool as a metaphysical razor that can be used to harness all these things.
It
and
also
cut into barriers and go to different worlds and. You know, it basically becomes the skeleton key, but a knife in a way.
I also do like, anyway, just when theories are like, can be created to sort of explain holes that are there anyway. Like, I see them, I give them more credence whenever they're kind of like useful, like to explain how he's Dragonborn and how, why he's not this particular brand of elf, according to, you know, how the lineage works.
I think Elder Scrolls fans are, at this point, masters of doing that, because there are so many times where we're forced to make up for some weird mistake in the games, you know, which is, you know, I don't mean to be mean to the devs, because there's a lot of stuff that goes into them, but, It's definitely a case that we find a load of stuff that doesn't make sense and we, like, help them to make it
honestly,
work.
Honestly, it's bound to happen when you have, like, you know, going... Because people have to... Like, the Arena Daggerfall is almost, like, a different era and a different kind of Tamriel almost. And then they sort of had a kind of softish reboot of a lot of things come Morrowind and Oblivion and Skyrim. And then it kind of... Each one of those iterations kind of... They're made by different writers and different people working on it. So, and they have different gameplay functions and features that they want lore for. And it just kind of evolves it. And then obviously Elder Scrolls Online comes about and that changes things as well. So it's kind of like hard to, you know, basically since I think it's like 94 or something, Zarina or something, but more or less like 24 kind of ish years of, Elder Scrolls history with all of these different people, it's hard to keep it like perfectly consistent. So you need to get, you know, your cope sword out and razor the lore a bit and like fix it up, you know, inside and out. Because it's like you'll even get that kind of disconnect with even things of like sort of the Battle Spire kind of era. There's just some, I know there's things in Battle Spire sometimes, you're like, oh yeah, like you know what I mean? It's like that, you can tell it doesn't fit the exact same sort of image of the Elder Scrolls.
I mean, you can completely see the massive art style change. I mean, everything in Battle Spire was super like sexual and like, you know, look at the Mazkin. They'll just be walking and then when they like jump out with wings, they become naked and like...
And it was very retro.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately sure. This is Meereen's Dagon's plan because he's enacting revolution and change. He takes down the old art style and reborn, you know, in Morrowind and so on, and he furthers it, you know. He's winning here.
That's
he's
what
the
happens.
Real winner.
He saw the art style of the characters in Oblivion and he was disgusted. So he had to destroy it. And essentially that's what he did to make Skyrim's character models.
Yeah, and then what's Elder Scrolls 6 going to look like? What kind of revolutions do you think he's gonna take? Like, how's he going to take it down, you know? Like, how's he going to take down Skyrim and replace it with Elder Scrolls 6, the new revolution of settlement building?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he gets us to build up all the settlements so he can tear them down.
In Elder Scrolls 7. Gosh, it's crazy to think that may actually be a thing one day.
I don't even know. That's know. Sort Me of like I'll probably be like 40 plus
50 years old.
Yeah,
like at this rate.
But so yeah, the Mysterium Xarxes has got heaps of cool stuff to it, and you know, being used with Razor, because also outside of just the razor by itself is just like, oh, it's a cool dagger. Really, it's like a legendary dagger, unless you consider all of the metaphysical things and its interactions with the Mythic Dawn commentaries and Mysterium Xarxes and
so. Yeah, its effect doesn't really work outside of game mechanics because, you know, like a chance to kill instantly can be useful against a powerful enemy. But if you've got this dagger and you're an assassin and you get and they say, oh, you know, there's a 2% chance it will kill them instantly. If you're an assassin... You know, if you're slitting throats, you don't really need to worry about a 2% chance. You're killing them instantly or you're a terrible assassin. It's as simple as that. So the effect kind of needs the metaphysical stuff to be interesting.
Yeah, because what you'd need to hit them like could be 50 times before you could guarantee that instant kill, by which they're probably dead anyway.
I don't know if you know off by heart, but I know his forearms are often associated with like different weather kind of things. Isn't there a thing like one of his things is storm and basically him just viewing weather as weapons, because I know he's also like got different weapons all the time, like the claws and axe and stuff like that. And one thing when you do look at his Daedric artifacts, he is kind of like, he has a lot of weaponry going around and like a lot of, he's credited with creating them. So like in the Spear of, there's different stories around the Spear of Bitter Mercy that he created, but he also like created the Daedric Crescents as like for all of his army and stuff, had these Daedric Crescents, and there's this Deadland Hammer, and then there's the Meereen's Razor itself, and then there's the Sword of the Moon Reaver. Like he has like a, you know, and I guess you do when you want a revolution army kind of, you know, bent on destruction. Mm. Weapons are at their core for destruction of something.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you even look at his theme in general, it fits perfectly with his army. Like Dremora, they're a very warlike Daedra. They may have served other Daedra before, but typically they're very, you know, hierarchical and war-based, and they have a lot of pride around their ability in combat. You know, it all fits perfectly. I'm surprised he even had a book as one of his artifacts, but I'm very glad that he did.
It's just his manifesto before he goes off attacking everything. Yeah. We can start, we can also just bring up, like, well, because there's some other interpretations, and there's one that just takes this fearsome looking character and completely trivializes him in the Khajiit pantheon. So being called, like, just, he's just like the fire kitten. Cat or whatever, but he's basically, yeah, he's a little destructive kitten. Because, like, you know how a little kitten will get somewhere and then, you know, they're just playing and destroying and, like, you know, tear up your clothes or something like that. But it's, that's the kind of vibe that... It's, I just like how they trivialize this giant, like, force of destruction by making him a little cat. I mean, they
do that with other things, but I guess it makes a bit more sense.
But he's like the only one that's like the, like, kitten is the kind of thing, Chloe Maroons. Like, I think all the others are sort of a little bit more. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, cat, because Khajiit version of the god, but, like, he's particularly got this.
Oh, like, I mean, Shea Gorath appears as, like, a skooma cat, like a little, but
well, plus with Maroons, he kind of, you know, Molag just battles him and then immediately enslaves him, so kind of like asserts his dominance over him too. So Maroons definitely gets a bit of the short end of the stick when it comes to Khajiit spirituality.
Yeah. I think, I mean, Dunma had a bunch of cool stuff after. I'll have to, like, verify the exact story again, but there's something vaguely about there's a rock that, I think it's Margon or something.
It's Margon.
Maerun's Dagon was going to throw a rock at all of these, like a meteory looking thing against all of these Dunma, but then Vivek sort of like kind of taunts him and basically tricks him into throwing the rock to where Vivek is, and then Vivek, you know, dodges, zips out of the way, whatever. But then the rock stays there and it becomes like a bit of like a sort of like a spiritual significance point where they go for pilgrimages and so on. And there's also the whole story with Vivek fighting Maerun's Dagon, and then where Maerun's Dagon loses his sword at one point, but then Vivek insists that he, you know, gives him a sword to use because, you know, there's no honor in fighting a unarmed opponent, and that forever gave Vivek respect in the eyes of the Dromora who serve Maerun's Dagon. But what I was talking about, the rock too, the importance there is, I just think in like older games, they did, like, and why I think Morrowind's liked a lot is they really made an effort to make the mythology and the world building of the world like kind of like tangible, like a place that you go to. I mean, it does exist in the other games, but it's like when you go to this, it kind of like environmentally unloads lore and so on. It's like, because everyone's like this big rock, and I think it's the place where there is a Dromora in front of it that, I think that might be the rock. I can't quite remember. But anyway, that having all of those environmental like cues and something, or like that provide history and context, it's kind of like encourages you to get into the religion and stuff instead of just reading it through books, because there's all of these places that you're going to explore in this open world and see. And then you'll get the context behind it, which then introduces you into the lore instead of like, oh, here you have to read a book to get it. Like, because I remember, like, dude, when I was a kid, like, I didn't really understand the Mythic Dawn's plans outside of vague, even evil kind of things. Because if you... His book is just like, it's you know what I mean? For starters, you have to read a book. Like, I didn't used to read books. I do now. But when I was a kid, I didn't read books in games. Like, I played a game to play a game, like, not read the book. So it's best if you can kind of, like, both is good, but you know what I mean? You just want a little bit more of it in the front and center of the game experience.
You got to consider as well, a lot of the Mythic Dawn members were a bit more evil in the sense that not all of them fully understood, like, what they were doing, you know, in its whole and the importance of everything like that. Like, a lot of them were kind of just like used for Mankar's cause.
Yeah.
And you know, when they all ended up in his realm of paradise, which he created, Gaia Alata, a lot of them ended up tortured, didn't they, for eternity. And that was kind of like, oh, if you serve me, you'll get to live eternity in paradise. But that's not what they had in mind.
Yeah. So... I don't know if we want to talk about it, like, we could, because we did bring this up again, but I did like the little line about, I think it was Gary Noonan talking about how her scene was intended to be a, like, leader of the armies, of Wamera and Dagon's armies, and they've had a bit of a close association, and you can kind of like extrapolate on that further with the Spear of Bitter Mercy being like supposedly created by either Hercene or Meeran's Dagon in other stories, or you know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's. I think it's believed commonly that Dagon created them, and Hercene just has one with a H on it for Hercene.
Yeah, and but no I mean, it depends on the myth. I'm pretty sure the Reachman myths about Hercene really like the spear is very
like his spear.
Hercene, yeah, like. Yeah. It's a different kind of... Because it's almost like they call him... They can call him like the spear... I think it's the Spear of Five Points. They actually call Hercene that because it's just like so... you know what I mean? Closely embodied with him.
Mm. I think that could actually be... Oh, hold on. Just one of his titles given to him by the Reach folk, the Spear with Five Points, is reflective of this. But for some reason, I always wondered if that was talking about Dagon or Hercene.
No, it's definitely talking about him.
Yeah, okay.
Because he's got the five aspects.
Yeah, right? That's right. Like, is it Aurebeg?
Aurebeg, yeah. Hunter.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I wonder, like, we don't actually... I mean, Haskell mentioned some stuff about Dagon. I was just thinking about interactions between Dagon and other Daedric princes. You don't... Because I don't know if there are many I don't think there are many stories about Dagon's like past. Because you know how you'll get I mean, they did add a lot of this in the Shivering Isles that Sheogorath interacts with like Vaemina and Hercene and all of these different characters because it came in the 16 Accords of Madness series of books. But I don't know if we get a lot of interaction.
Yeah, Haskell kind of despises him, to be honest. I'm trying to find the exact quote, but there's... so you know, it's kind of a question is asked of Haskell basically about you know, kind of what it means for them to be Daedra and Daedric princes and whatnot, and Haskell typically, as you'd expect, his answer is essentially like, you have no understanding of this topic, your choice of to use the word Daedra means nothing to us. And this is what he specifically says: your lore of those disparate beings that you lump together as Daedra is based on nothing, lies and half truths told by traitors, rebels, miscontents, and weaklings, which he's kind of referring to the Aedra there, who have had the misfortune to become involved with mortals or with Meeran's Dagon. Do not speak his name to me again. The master of scum, the pawn of every prince of true power, the dupe of every schemer in the 19 voids.
Mm.
So you know. Not a great deal of respect there.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, he is brought up in the kind of Khajiit story, at least, if you were to talk of his interactions with other Daedra, but they are more kind of like, limited. It sounds weird, but origins in origin. Like
The Khajiit story is essentially the same as the Lig one, is the idea, well, except for Molag. So essentially Molag enslaves Meeran's Dagon in the Khajiit story, and it's Molag's wife, Meridia, or lover, I'm not sure what their relationship is in their stories, frees him so that he can assault the Lunar Lattice, yeah. Which is essentially Azura's barrier that protects Mundus from oblivion. So kind of like, you know, the plan is basically just to use him to destroy the world, except here Meridia is much more aware of what she's doing.
Also, looping back to how we were talking about Molag Bal in... relative to him, is that they're said to be bitter rifles. And this is just in one of those like Loremaster archive kind of questions or so on. But it makes sense as well in that regard, like how he wouldn't just become Molag Bal of Domination. Like his point is only like, like we kind of said at the start, is chaotic neutral. He's just there to bring down the top and then that's it. He does, because it's kind of like it's bringing everything down, but not rebuilding it and not asserting control over the things. And like the whole Mythic Dawn, the idea he just brings the Dawn back to the Dawn era. It's kind of almost like, I guess, a return to chaos. Like he's the ultimate anarchist almost, you know, like.
Which is kind of like with Haskell saying he's a pawn, you know, to princes of greater power. Mm. Is that essentially he is at the end of the day, a tool of destruction. Mm. And once he's done there, you know, he hasn't got a strict, you know, set of rules to reestablish society and a prospering civilization. He's got no interest in that.
A good way, like, I guess, too, like, you could envision Meeryn's Dagon as the ultimate anarchist and Molag Bal as the ultimate dictator. Like, they're just complete opposite ends of the spectrum, like hyper-authoritarian and hyper-chaos.
Yeah, so they're kind of useful together. You know, you want that anarchist to pave the way for the tyrant.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That's it's a crazy never-ending cycle in that regard. Yeah, I don't know what else there is to because there's things that I guess we kind of skim over a little bit more because. Kind of assumed, like, I mean
he has all these different stories. Yeah, like, we know the Oblivion Crisis story, we know in Skyrim how his razor was split into pieces and you recover it and probably kill Silas for it instead of getting just a little bit of gold. Well, depends on your role playing. There's also that story though about the Chimera of Desolation, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
where he but he like creates this small realm of Oblivion, but it's basically like this revenge trick against this conjurer called Chimere Gregan. I think that's the pronunciation. But basically, one of his wishes or something was to be like in his hometown with his friends and hearing their laughter or something like that. And then Dagon basically like just ripped the whole town into oblivion, killing everyone that he cared about. But then like you can still hear the laughter.
Mm. Yeah. It's creepy. Yeah, I'm curious. What do you think they'll actually do with the Elder Scrolls Online stuff? It's called Jaws of Oblivion. So just think of that as the.
Oh, sorry. Wasn't it? Wasn't the laughter? It was the happy voices. Still very creepy.
I think you said it earlier, Scott. I think it has to be an invitation as opposed to an invasion, because it'd be much easier to kind of. To conjure a story where you go into the Deadlands. Like, I'm fairly sure there is a quest in ESO that involves vaguely going into the Deadlands around the around Meyrune's Razor, but I didn't actually do the quest, so I can't say for sure. But I think it could be a good way to kind of take the iconic Deadlands from Oblivion and make it an explorable region like Cold Harbor without necessarily doing an invasion.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, sorry, Gates of Oblivion, by the way, is what it's called. Jaws of Oblivion is the Elder Scrolls Legends DLC. It's called Gates of Oblivion. Maybe I hope this is such a big hope that they're like, maybe they're like telegraphing with the Meyrin's Dagon stuff because it's relevant. But maybe there could also be like other gates you go to, like some other realms that it involves a bit more than just Dagon.
Or maybe they're just getting everyone hyped for Oblivion Remastered, revealed at E3 this year.
Do you know what? I'm kind of on board with the whole, like, I don't think we need remasters, to be honest. Like,
no, we don't. I'd prefer all that effort to go into Elder Scrolls 6 or a new game.
Yeah.
I wouldn't complain if that's what they released. I'd be like, cool, I'm definitely going to play it.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is with a straight up remaster is like, I do like that like Pokemon approach, like, you know, with like Heart Gold and Soul Silver. Remember, they like really put in a lot of like,
it's more like an overhaul stuff.
Yeah, it's more than just better graphics, because like, which, you know, would be fine if you like Oblivion's combat like felt good, or I mean Morrowind to be honest deserves it more in that regard. Like if you brought it up to sort of modern standards or something.
I don't think all the modders working on redoing that would be very happy, would they? Kind of throw their whole project into the wind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but I don't think it's going to be enormously kind of groundbreaking or creative. This is probably just an expansion to kind of give a bit of, you know, brand recognition and kind of going back into something everyone's nostalgic about. But, you know, if you said that it involves other gates to other Daedric Prince realms, kind of like doing a Morian Zenis Doors of Oblivion style storyline, then that could be cool. Yeah. But I doubt it.
I'll tell you what, they've kind of got to, like, I know that there's some cool stuff that came out of the Skyrim DLC, the most recent, the Greymoor stuff. And the Markarth stuff. There's some cool stuff in there, but I feel like following up with this, it's kind of like, oh, you're going to Skyrim again. And now it's like, oh, now we're going to go to, you know, Oblivion themed stuff again. Like, you know, the same topic material. I feel like they should like mix it up a little bit and throw in some other things. Like, because think about it. Like, most of the DLCs, it's like, oh, we're going to Morrowind. We're going to do Vardenfell again. Okay, now we're going to do Skyrim again. Like, Somerset was unique. Elsewhere was unique. And obviously, there's some, like, smaller ones and stuff, like Orsinium. But
I do think it is somewhat a case of, you know, BGS working on Elder Scrolls 6 have been like, you can't mess with the areas of the map that we're going to be exploring in the Elder Scrolls 6, because we kind of want to generate the hype around that area for the new game. So they've probably covered all the provinces they can. Maybe they could visit Valenwood, because
Valenwood is there. Like, if you look at the I'll just find it. There's the ESO like map that covers all their expansions, and really I'm pretty sure it was just a little bit of, there's bits of Cyrodiil still uncovered, but then there's good chunks of Hammerfell. Like, they've done some Hammerfell.
You know, but what the master plan is, it's not because they don't want to spoil Hammerfell. It's because they want to make Hammerfell Elder Scrolls Online expansion packs after Hammerfell has hype, right? So they put out Hammerfell Elder Scrolls 6, and then to get more Elder Scrolls Online attention, they do Hammerfell DLC. It's not because they don't want to spoil it.
But
they
got to fill the same 3 years.
Yeah, but
that seems crazy to me. Like, imagine it's like, oh, I'm so excited to explore like really rich and detailed Hammerfell in this game that's been worked on for 5 years. I'm so excited. I'm going to jump into this like kind of somewhat half-assed ESO expansion of the same region.
Oh, they do it. They do it years later. And I guess if they have the Elder Scrolls Online fans already there who would pay for it, then it's a win for them. But yeah, totally agree. I would have zero desire to explore Hammerfell. But then again, look at everyone excited to explore Skyrim in Elder Scrolls Online when they could just play Skyrim.
But yeah, I guess, but they're excited for more, just more content.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
But if you were to look at the three spaces left, there's a big chunk of Hammerfell. There's a big chunk of Western Cyrodiil, and then there's a big chunk of Blackmarsh that they could still like, where you could put like a big size of stuff in there. And if you think of that, 2021 is this Jaws of Oblivion thing, and then there's 3 more years, 2024 Elder Scrolls 6, you know?
Yeah. I just wanted to come sooner.
Yeah.
We need to get Mehrunes Dagon to do some ambitious speeding up of this process.
He can tear down Starfield and kind of devote all that energy into an earlier Elder Scrolls series.
Or he could just destroy the franchise. Dawn Era Revolution.
Oh, no. Well, I suppose there's some artifacts that we haven't really talked about too much, but I don't know how much detail we really need to go in about them. I mean, like you kind of mentioned there's the Deadland Hammer, which you can use to summon Iron Atronachs, which is quite weird. But they don't look, in Elder Scrolls Online particularly, they look very much like magma Atronachs. Like there's a fiery element to them. They don't look like iron robotic mechs or something.
Yeah. Yeah. There was just this one other little line about like that they're cultists. They can... signs of their cultists that there's tremors or something. I just lost what I was reading, but basically that when their cultists are acting, they can be, hold on 1 second.
Signs of cultist activity include that, unusual tremors, no rain, more rain as they attempt to incite natural disaster.
It's from another lore thing, but I do like the natural disaster element a little bit more. They just throw it in there rather than just destruction. Like, yeah, I don't know. I can imagine him sort of like with one arm being like a meteor, one with like a tornado, one with like a lightning bolt, and one with like, I don't know, tidal wave or something. Like, I like that kind of...
Which it does, you know, it kind of does say in the Mysterious Arxes that we went over before, is like, you know, in each of his forearms holds the four keys, you know, the rush of plague, rain, the storm, and all of that. So yeah, it is a cool element of him that makes him a bit more dynamic.
I mean, you guys can actually let us know in the comments too how you would like us to do these videos, because often we find, I mean, you've been enjoying them so far, but often there's a lot of like, we can talk way more on the metaphysical elements, but then kind of like miss some of the more insignificant kind of like, in 389 he had a dagger that did this or something like that. Or do you know what I mean? Like there's some more of the sort of insignificant details or that you could just sort of, you know, I guess assumed knowledge. Like, I guess we sort of go in like that, you know what Oblivion's about, like the Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion. So,
I don't know. Everyone could always use a recap. Let us know. What's your level of assumed knowledge in the comments?
Let us know if you need more hand holding.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say I'm a bit guilty of that when I start the podcast talking about how he was born in League to destroy the gods.
Oh, no. We've Scott lost. Has achieved.
You know what? We're done. Let's roll without him. Do you want to end the podcast this time?
Thank everyone for tuning in. Dagon has Scott in the Deadlands for eternity, and we look forward to nerding out with you all again very soon.